supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A few months before Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, the civil rights icon launched a major effort to end poverty for all races. He called it the Poor People's Campaign. 50 years later, activists have reignited that unfinished fight, starting today with demonstrations at state capitals across the country, including Harrisburg, Trenton, and Dover. WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports.
King laid out the broad strokes of his Poor People's Campaign during a Sunday sermon in 1968, just a few days before he was fatally shot in Memphis.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists."
Those words resonate with Pat Albright, a longtime activist who traveled to Harrisburg today for the first of 6 rallies relaunching King's campaign. Albright grew up lower middle class, but has struggled to make ends meet almost her entire adult life. After dropping out of college to help organize against the Vietnam War, Albright went on welfare, then disability. Not having a bachelor's degree made it hard to find work that paid a living wage. A hearing problem, along with anxiety and depression, made it even harder to keep the job she was able to get.
I was fortunate that I wasn't homeless and so on, but it was very difficult and hard work to try to raise a child as best I could in a situation of poverty.
Albright lives on less than $15,000 a year, squarely below the federal poverty line for a single mom. She doesn't have to pay rent. Her parents left her enough money to buy a row home in the Germantown section of Philadelphia after they died, but she says money is still really tight.
If we would go out to dinner, maybe I'd have a cup of coffee because I really couldn't afford to buy a meal, you know, so that I could at least have the company with people. And sometimes people didn't understand. They say, "Okay, well, let's all split this bill." So that kind of thing is, you know, can be awkward, and you start to feel kind of embarrassed.
Since the first Poor People's Campaign was launched in 1968, the gap between rich and poor has widened. Roberta Everson researches poverty and economic mobility at the University of Pennsylvania.
Income inequality now is, you know, through the roof in relation to what it was in the mid-1960s. The CEOs in certainly the 50s, 60s were maybe paid 15% to 30% more than their average worker, and now it's 350% in many places.
Census data show the percentage of people living in poverty was effectively the same as it is today, roughly 13% in Pennsylvania. But the country's economy was much different. Everson says people like Albright could feed a family without a college education. There were still plenty of manufacturing jobs. Where she lives in Philadelphia, that option has greatly diminished thanks to deindustrialization. Everson says that's left a lot of people stuck working minimum wage jobs and made economic mobility, moving out of poverty, incredibly difficult.
It's practically impossible. There's a very small slice.
The platforms of the two campaigns are also pretty different. King had lofty goals, but they were more concrete. A lot of it was about funding. Participants wanted people to have a guaranteed annual wage, the federal government to build thousands of affordable houses, and Congress to pass a so-called Economic Bill of Rights, which, among other things, would create at least 1 million public service jobs. The new campaign has a much broader agenda. Nishmi Zarinko is an organizer with the Pennsylvania chapter of the Poor People's Campaign.
Our society needs immediate action on systemic racism, poverty, the war economy, and environmental devastation. That those 4 issues should really be at the center of every political conversation, of every debate, of every news story really needs to be, what are we doing as a society about these 4 evils?
The National Campaign's website lists nearly 24 demands, each linked in some way to those themes. Zarinko admits it's ambitious.
even though people see a lot of issues and think, oh, this is so many different things, we're actually talking about how they're connected and they're inseparable, and we actually can't move on one unless we also move on the others.
Going forward, organizers across the country, including Pennsylvania, plan to hold demonstrations every week for the next 6 weeks. Then the first phase of the campaign will conclude just as the original one did, with a large rally on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in June. The next steps are unclear, but the effort is expected to continue in the years ahead. Organizers say getting lawmakers on every level of government to make poverty a priority won't happen overnight. Aaron Mosell, WHYY News.
Let's try to get more clarity on the next steps with Jean Friedman-Rudofsky, Executive Director of Resolve Philadelphia. Jean, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
And specifically, let's try to get clarity on the next 12 months, and that's the duration of this new project called Broke in Philly. Explain.
Yeah, so Broken Philly is a collaborative reporting project on solutions to poverty and economic justice here in Philadelphia.
HYY is one of the collaborators.
It is, along with HYY and 18 other local news outlets here in Philly that are all doing dedicated reporting on this topic for at least the next year.
And what's the goal?
I think the goal is, I'd say, twofold. One is to really kind of raise the level of awareness of the problem that we have in Philadelphia. You know, I think a lot of people know that a quarter of our population lives below the federal poverty line. What some people may not know is that one in two people in this city is not what economists would call economically self-sufficient, which means, you know, earning enough to not have some sort of external or outside assistance.
Let's pause and reflect on that. Almost one in two.
48% live at 200% of the poverty line or below. And the federal poverty line is so low, it is trapped so low, that even earning double means that it is hard to survive, particularly in a city like Philadelphia. So what that means is for a family of three earning less than $41,000 a year, 48% of our city is at that level or lower.
So above and beyond bringing awareness to the scope of the problem, what is the other aspect of the project?
So the other aspect is to actually look at how we can move forward. So this project is sort of based on an approach to journalism called solutions journalism. And what that is rigorous reporting about responses to social problems rather than just the problems themselves. So what we try to do is identify what's working in this area, you know, what's working in terms of affordable housing, raising income levels, building people's wealth, keeping people from dropping into deep poverty, you know, sort of a wide array, focusing reporting on what's working, how does that happen, what's working elsewhere that we can bring to Philadelphia, and also learning from failure. So what has Philadelphia been trying for a very long time and is not working, and what can be learned from that experience?
Of course, best treatment is predicated on an accurate diagnosis. We heard Aaron talk about deindustrialization as a factor. Your work cites other variables as well.
So, yes, we've sort of identified, and this is not just sort of our reporting, but it's actually built on some great reporting that was done in 2013 in a series called Tapped Out by the Daily News. And what I would say a lot of people in Philadelphia, historians and economists, lay as a basis for this problem is deindustrialization, hyper-segregation, which I know WHYY has done a lot of reporting on.
And we continue to do stories on redlining.
Exactly. Because even though it's sort of a historical contributing factor, it's still going on.
Modern history.
Yep. Criminal justice debt. So, you know, as we know, Philadelphia has the highest incarcerated population proportionally to any large city in the United States. We also have 200 to 300,000 people who have spent time in prison in this city, people with criminal records. And that adds, you know, layers of debt. It's different for different people, but everything from fines, restitution, child support that was racked up while they were inside, all sorts of problems that can lay the basis for severe debt. And, you know, education, which, again, WHYY covers a lot, but looking at, you know, historically underfunded public schools and real educational disparities that, you know, later in life mean that people are earning less.
So given the durability and the pervasiveness of those important pillars, those problems, what critical mass can be assembled to try to change things?
Well, I think, you know, like any deeply rooted social problem, yes, it's hard and it's complex. But if you marshal in, you know, public policy resources, grassroots support for initiatives, you know, stuff that can happen on a community and a neighborhood level, academics and researchers who, you know, sometimes know what works. It's a question of, you know, getting other people to sort of leverage the power to actually make that happen. The goal of the project is to sort of, you know, combine all of these forces and say, here, something can be done. Yes, it's hard. Yes, it's going to take a long time. You know, there's no easy solution. But if we get all of these, you know, stakeholders and groups involved and invigorated and engaged on the issue, something can change.
Though Broken Philly is limited by a 12-month duration, much like reentry, I assume this will go on and on as well.
Yeah, I hope it will. And, you know, for now, we're saying 12 months. I hope that we're able to, you know, raise enough funding to keep this going so that it lasts at least through the end of next year, the end of 2019, I think would be excellent. Because, yeah, it's, you know, there's not going to be a lack of stories or a lack of reporting to do.
If for some reason we're no longer broken a year, we can stop it then.
Exactly.
Jean, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Jean Friedman-Rudofsky, Executive Director of Resolve Philadelphia. Garden State gamblers rejoice. The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a 1992 federal law restricting sports betting to Nevada and three other states, and that paves the way for sports betting nationwide. Former New Jersey Senator Ray Lesniak has been fighting for years to legalize sports wagering in New Jersey, and he's thrilled with the Supreme Court's decision.
It's going to be a big boost for Atlantic City, a big boost for Monmouth Racetrack. It'll bring people to those venues, keep jobs, create jobs, benefit the state of New Jersey. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Assemblyman John Berzicelli says the Assembly might act next week on a bill to set the state's regulations and tax rate for sports wagering. He says time is of the essence.
Pennsylvania will act quickly, New York will act quickly, Connecticut will act quickly, Delaware will act quickly, Maryland will act quickly. They all have casinos. So we'll probably have a short advantage.
The Supreme Court decision eliminates Delaware's East Coast monopoly on sports betting. Since 2009, Delaware was the only state east of the Mississippi to offer parlay bets on NFL games. Those football bets had to be on a minimum of three games at a time. And while Delaware casinos expected to see some increase in revenue by expanding to other types of bets on other sports, that loss of exclusivity will hurt. That assessment from Dover Downs Casino CEO Ed Suter.
We currently get over 40% of our sports betting occur from customers who live outside the state. So if they have that activity in their own state, then it's likely they would remain there. So we may not. It may not be the silver bullet that the state of Delaware casinos are looking for.
Governor John Carney says Delaware could start offering full-scale sports betting before the end of June. As Pennsylvania voters head to the polls for tomorrow's primary election, some may be surprised to learn that their congressional district has changed. Keystone Crossroads' Lindsay Lazarski reports that members from both parties expect some confusion tomorrow.
Days before the primary, about 25 North Philadelphia Democrats gathered for a meeting near the border of two recently reshaped congressional districts. On a table with campaign literature, flyers that said re-elect Congressman Dwight Evans were neatly tucked away and replaced with others that support Congressman Brendan Boyle. Shirley Gregory is a neighborhood leader for the local Democratic Party. The area she represents was moved into a different congressional district that includes voters from the opposite side of the city.
I just want everyone to know that there is mass confusion in this congressional race. And I think that to have the ward meetings is going to help clear up the problems.
Gregory's volunteers have been spreading the word to voters about the change to their district. Back in February, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court overhauled the state's congressional map after finding the old version an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander. The court dramatically changed the geography of all 18 districts, renumbering most of them. Political analysts expect the changes to help Democrats in a year that some say the party could take control of the House of Representatives. That may be why it's Republicans who are being most vocal about how the court's decision could cause voter confusion.
You go to the polls, you thought you were represented by, you know, Congressman Rothfuss or Congressman Fitzpatrick, and then you find out you're not. I mean, that's troubling.
Val DiGiorgio is Pennsylvania's Republican Party chairman. Since the court released the new map, he says it's been a scramble to get ready for this year's primary and still calls foul on the Democratic majority court.
What we have here is a partisan attempt to change maps for the benefit of the Democrat Party. And that's plain and simple what it was by the Supreme Court.
State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, another Philadelphia Democratic neighborhood leader, says the old map was clearly rigged by Republicans and needed to be thrown out. But he also expects a significant amount of confusion among voters at the polls.
The change of the lines is appropriate. The problem is that people just aren't used to it.
He's especially concerned because his area in West Philadelphia is now split between two congressional districts. And while the state and other local officials have done some outreach to inform voters, Williams says it's not enough. Wanda Murren is Director of Communications for the Pennsylvania Department of State, which is in charge of elections.
I've seen the concern, certainly. We don't expect any voter confusion because of the new congressional districts.
Murren advises voters to go to the VotesPA website to find their new district and notes that the map change didn't affect polling places. Lindsay Lazarski, Keystone Crossroads.
The active Kilauea volcano on Hawaii's Big Island is actively reminding residents and visitors of its ability to wreak havoc. Powerful volcanoes were much more prolific during Earth's and our solar system's earlier history. Let's go back in time and then look ahead with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, let's start with a refresher. What causes a volcano?
Well, a volcano is caused by the internal actions within a planetary body in which you have hot magma, liquid rock essentially, able to flow around from one place to another. Our Earth has a molten core surrounded by an outer core and then a mantle and then the crust. Now, the inner core is where we have the actual liquid core. But the heat that is generated by the decomposition of radioactive minerals in the mantle causes the molten activity that we see in our crust. Because our crust is now moving around over cells of heat from the mantle, the plates that make up our crust are moved around, and at the boundaries of those plates we find volcanic activity.
Do all rocky planets have a similar composition?
Yes, they do have a similar composition. The mechanism is about the same, although, as it turns out, of the four rocky planets of the inner solar system, Earth is the only one that actually is still volcanically active. We can look at the other planets and see that in their past history, they too have been volcanically active. In fact, the largest volcano in the solar system has been known to be Olympus Mons on Mars, Mount Olympus on Mars. But if we look around, we can certainly easily see that Venus at one time had a tremendous amount of volcanic activity, perhaps not too long ago, as recently as maybe 2.5 million years ago. And we know that's probably the case for Mercury as well.
So is Earth the only entity in our solar system that still has active volcanoes?
No, not at all. In fact, there are still active volcanoes at some of the moons of the outer planets of our solar system. So we look at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. These gas giants, as we call them, actually have very, very, very cold atmospheres, hundreds of degrees below zero. So you would assume that there isn't any activity there. But if you look at the moons, there is tidal activity between the giant planets themselves and the rest of the moons of a planetary system that cause the interiors of the moons to have a liquid magma-like substance. And probably the best known case in point is the moon of Jupiter, known as Io. In fact, some observations suggest that the moon itself gets completely resurfaced once every few million years. There's so much volcanic activity on Io.
Derek, so much in the news of the advent of private ventures in accelerating our space program, and that model is being adopted to varying degrees by other countries as well.
And most surprisingly, by China, a place that we might not have thought would adopt similar plans to other space agencies from around the world. Most recently, at a Chinese space conference, the news agency China Daily reports that China is really planning to develop space stations, lunar and Martian exploration capability, but most surprisingly, reusable first-stage rocket boosters, very much like SpaceX has demonstrated here in the United States over the last several years. What I find most surprising about China's plans is that they also plan to provide commercial launch services for clients worldwide, as well as developing the capability for private space tourism to be able to take place as well.
Check with your travel agent for updated rates.
There could be a cheap way to get to space sooner than we expect.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.